Hey, this is Mike from the High Hash Rate Podcast. Before we get started, I just want to do a brief shout out to a partnership of ours, the Freedom Festival 2024 in the heart of New England on May 4th. Participate in a unique celebration where the pursuit of freedom, health, and community values come together through engaging activities and inspiring experiences. Immerse yourself in all things Bitcoin. That's right, including Bitcoin speakers, Bitcoin music, Texas Slim's Cattleman's Feast Barbecue, Bitcoin workshops, and etc. Participate in interactive demonstrations like parkour, cold plunge, wow, that sounds fun, hot tub, a soccer contest, and a raffle with prizes. Buy your tickets today. You can enter our affiliate link, HighRate20, for a 20% discount. You could also visit, for more information, massadoption.net. Anyway, on to our show.
Screw it. Here we go.
If you decide to spend your time, a finite thing, on something, and you are being paid with something that can infinitely be created, that is just not a rational thing to do.
Hey, everybody. This is the High Hash Rate Podcast. I'm Mike.
And I'm Dan.
And this podcast is just two plebs getting high and talking about Bitcoin, life, and the absurdity of the fiat world. Our guests don't necessarily get high with us, and you don't have to either.
But it helps.
Yo, welcome back to High Hash Rate. It is a beautiful mid-70s, 20 degrees Celsius, depending on how you measure, day here in the Midwest. But I am in the studio talking Bitcoin because there's nothing I'd rather be doing. Today we're talking to Bram Canstein. He's got the Bitcoin for Millennials podcast. He's also an entrepreneur and an early stage startup kind of expert or consultant. So Bram, how's it going?
Yeah, all good, guys. We finally made it. It took some time for us to schedule, but it's always difficult with this time difference, right? But here it's a nice Sunday evening, so I'm happy to share it with you guys.
Great, great. Yeah, last episode we recorded was with Cedric Youngelman, and we had probably attempted that episode four or five times before we finally got him on the recording. So similar story here, but yeah, great, man. So first thing I want to know is, how was Bitcoin Atlantis? I was watching from social media, very jealous of all the pictures, all the videos, all the speakers. It seemed like a pretty good turnout, but like also intimate enough where you were probably able to meet and have some great discussions with some great Bitcoiners. Pretty jealous about that.
Oh, I loved it so much. It was so great. This was my second Bitcoin conference. My first was in Amsterdam at the end of last year, which was, of course, like down in the bear market. So it was only the crazy people who were left that actually went to the conference. But, you know, in general, it's just really fun to meet people that you know from the internet in real life. You know, like, I don't know how it is for you guys, but like my real life Bitcoin circle is very small. It's like two or three people. And like online, it's hundreds, thousands of people, right, that you communicate with. So when you go to a conference, and especially when you fly to an island to go to a conference, it's, man, that the energy, I don't know if you saw Jack Mahler's talk that was shared. Yeah. That was like the opening talk. And it was like, you know, Jack Mahler's going to explain Bitcoin. And I was like, yeah, I know this. I know this stuff. But that talk, man, electrifying, crazy. Like, you could feel the energy on the...
Right, they cover a lot of elementary things, like stuff that you already know about. But it's different when you're there listening to it in person, surrounded by hundreds, maybe thousands of other Bitcoiners there to listen to it. It's almost like, I hate to use this analogy, but it's almost like a religious service, a church service, where it's like,
oh yeah,
you're hearing the same thing over and over again.
100%. Yeah. So you know the stuff, but I think Jack's talk was really good. Like, I would implore anyone to look at it, because for me, even after 10 years in Bitcoin, this was probably, and I tweeted this out, like, this is probably the best explainer on Bitcoin I've ever seen. Top three, definitely. Probably the best, actually. And just being there and hearing that and really feeling that, you know, there's other people that understand or are interested in the same thing that you are interested in. I mean, I had that same experience actually in Amsterdam when I arrived, I walked into a presentation of Rational Root, and I was just looking around, and I was like, wow, all these people are into the same thing as me. You know, like seriously, like first time ever. Like, it's so different than when, you know, you meet people like this online, or you interact on Twitter like that, that there's real people who are interested in the same thing. It's just mind blowing. And then in Madeira, like you said, it was really intimate. I think they sold like 2,500 tickets or something. Also lots of locals. And it was like in a stadium, like in the stadium. Yeah,
looked like a unique venue.
But it was super intimate. Like, you could talk to all the speakers. I met everyone who had been on my podcast. I think Jeff Booth spent like 2 hours just on the outside boardwalk, just talking to random people, like also approachable. And, you know, like, as you mentioned, like my background is like in tech and startups. And if you go to conferences like that, there's no way you talk to the speakers like that. Sure. Like, it's not an intimate gathering. Right. And the cult kind of like feeling, which I love to use the word cult, actually.
Good. Okay, good. I do too, but it's like, you know.
Yeah. No, I love
start
it.
By episode
I love
way.
It because everyone is so triggered by it. But you just, like, everyone is into the same thing. And it doesn't matter where you come from, how old you are, what your background is, what you look like. Like, all these things are so irrelevant in Bitcoin.
And you said this is what, your second podcast? Or not your podcast, your second conference?
Yeah.
Okay, so I've been to multiple conferences, right? And they all have a semblance or an element of what you talked about, and they're great. But there's something about, so this is maybe probably not the same today, but early on going to Bitcoin Beach in El Salvador, where, like I said, we brought this up multiple times, but where I met Mike, something about that, there was like this difficulty to get down there. It's not like New York City or Amsterdam even. It's even to get to Madeira, you got to fly to Europe and then you got to catch a flight to the island, and it's harder to get there. It's a smaller, intimate feeling, and just being there, it has this different feeling of where everybody, like you said, everybody is closer. You're able to speak to all of the major speakers like Jack and Jeff Booth and guys like that, and I think that I want to find more conferences and more meetups and get-togethers with that kind of setup, where it's kind of a difficulty to get to, and it just makes it feel more magical when you're there.
Yeah. It also felt for me a bit like this could have been a conference that would have been held like, I don't know, 6 years ago or something. You know,
sure.
Like that's small with that many people that, you know, others follow to hear their thoughts, etc. Like, it really felt like that. It really felt like despite the subject, it felt like an early conference for whatever the subject would be, right?
And well, we're still early.
Well, definitely, yeah. But also, I went alone, and I spent 4 days with two, three other guys, and we just talked about everything, like not about the weather, but like just only deep stuff and big ideas, and just challenging each other was just so fun to see how, it's a certain type of, I think, thinkers or certain type of people that are attracted to Bitcoin, you know, yeah.
It had, well, from the pictures, it had this feeling of maybe like an elite or like a celebrity gathering. Like, I don't think I've seen another conference that I was so sort of drawn to, like, oh man, this person's meeting that person and this person's here. And oh my gosh, it feels like almost like a can in a way. Like,
Yeah, you had like the lightning guys like Jack Mahler's hanging out with, like Pablo, and the guys from Noster and Tank. And it was like, oh shoot, like what's going to be the collaboration that comes out of that?
yeah. No, it definitely felt like that. Also the roster, I think, crazy. And actually the last day, which I loved, was there was like a huge fireside chat with, I think, Jeff Booth, Preston Pish, James Lavish, and Lynn Alden. And anyone in the stadium could ask them a question. And they did it for like 90 minutes or almost 2 hours, I think. It was
that
just like an impromptu thing, and anyone could just ask a question. And I mean, like that, I've done a lot of like these company workshops, you know, for idea validation and stuff like that. And you can share like information, but the discussion is always the most interesting, because you also learn from how people ask a question, right? And you can question yourself like, hey, where did that question come from? And then you can listen to the answer. And so it was just really cool to see like a session like that with 2,000 people and these four panelists and any question like noob questions, pro questions, like anything, everything across the board, basically.
Kind of like, yeah. Kind of like how Clubhouse or Twitter Spaces, like the ultimate version of that, except for instead of online on Twitter, it's you're in this beautiful, like, I don't know, is it a volcanic island setup?
Yeah, it was super fun. So I would implore anyone to go to a Bitcoin conference. You can even go alone. You'll make friends on day one. Yeah.
How many podcast interviews did you line up out there?
I think five.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah, something well, like that.
Yeah, that kind of gets me into the next question, which is like, what for our listeners, can you share kind of your Bitcoin story? You come from like a tech startup background. How did you, or what were you working on before? And like, what has been your evolution since you discovered Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I've always been into like computers and digital products, like digital companies. So, and well, later I found out they are called startups, right? But in the beginning, it was always about, yeah, I love to see what people are spending their time on, basically. So when I just mentioned the word ideas, like ideas for me are very, that's been like one of the main topics in my life, I think, and eventually also in my career. Like I love to understand where people's ideas came from and see if I can dissect them to one, maybe learn from myself, right? I always see that as inspiration. But I think second, and that's also what eventually became a big part of like my career, is to help people dissect it for themselves. Like, where did this come from? What are your assumptions? You know, why do you think this is a good idea? When would you decide to actually pursue it, right? Like spend more time, money, and energy on it. And especially in like the business space, like lots of people have ideas, but you know, I believe that ideas, you know, just float around in the universe, and sometimes they come to you, right? And of course, everyone falls in love with their own ideas, but most ideas suck, which is fine. But once you realize that, you also realize that you have work to do when you think you have a great idea, right? You have work to do to basically protect yourself from wasting time, money, and energy on the wrong idea. So you have to validate your ideas in a certain way up until a certain point, in order to really decide, you know, if you wanna pursue something. And so I've been on like the edge of business strategy, product development for the past 10 years in lots of different roles. So from an investor side to worked for Product Hunt, had my own growth marketing agency, failed at lots of my own ideas, also sold a few. And now I'm currently in this transition phase, basically, where I do consults like a few days a week, and the rest of my days are filled with building this Bitcoin-focused podcast, which I started 6 months ago. And my goal is to just, I want to transition fully into Bitcoin. And I think just over 6 months ago, so just before starting the podcast, I just realized, like, I've been in this for so long. Like, I know what this is. I know where this is going. Like, why am I'm not spending my life on this, basically.
Right.
I think it was Bob Burnett. I saw him, Boomer BTC, love that name. I saw him in a podcast, I think it was in the Bitcoin Matrix, actually, with Cedric Youngelman. And he said, like, this is the biggest thing you can contribute to in the world, basically.
100%.
And you have a moment in time where you can actually decide to do that, something like that. I'm butchering the quote, but it doesn't really matter. And at that point, I was like, yeah, like I need to do this. I know how big this will be, and I want to contribute to that.
Yeah, you mentioned the ideas and listening to people's ideas and trying to define or figure out what ideas are good, and that's really kind of the basis, looking back on this podcast too, and the way that we kind of handle our social media. We've made a lot of jokes, and we kind of focused on the idea of memes early on, and we still do. But the more I think about it, especially when I've been really, really high, which is what I like to do at night, listen to podcasts and go for walks, I like to think big picture, is that memes are kind of the quickest like MVP of an idea that you can put out there for people and connect. And you can like, you can think you have a great idea for a meme, for example. You put it out, nobody likes it, nobody shares it, or you put something out there and it just takes off. And you kind of follow that feedback and you put out similar types of memes or ideas and they just start to take off. It's that you're finding your audience. You're finding people who like your ideas, like the idea you're sharing, and you're kind of building this prototype of what kind of content can I create? What kind of product can I create? And who am I speaking to? And how am I trying to sell that to them? And it just kind of grows from there. And I think that one of the most important skills that somebody can have in the next, in the future, the next few decades, is the ability to just constantly come up with new ideas and be critical of their own ideas, be critical of others' ideas. And so I'm wondering how has your understanding evolved in this? Like, have you figured out where your source of inspiration comes from for new ideas? How have you learned to be more critical of your own ideas and not to just fall in love with them and spend too much time on them?
That's a really good question. I think I also fall in love with my own ideas. Like everyone has that, right? But it's just the kind of like mental model that I adopted is there's an infinite amount of ideas, right? So it is a numbers game per definition, right? And an idea can come to you at any moment. It's also, I don't know who said that, but I think it's proven that like, if you don't pick up on the idea, like I see the ideas as like a radio signal, right? And, we can go into this, but your head is like an antenna, right? And then you get this idea. Like if you don't act upon the idea, it will also be gone. Well, especially when you're high, you know that, you can go in all these directions. But then when it's gone, it's really gone, right? And so if you don't write it down, that's one, I think. And then two, to act upon it, basically, you have to. So one is there's an infinite amount of ideas, so it's a numbers game by definition. So most ideas suck, right? When you have something that you want to know more about, you first have to have like an introspection of like, okay, what is the basis of this idea? How do I substantiate this idea? And does that make any sense, right? So there already you have like this little ego battle going on, because you'll be like, oh no, this idea is amazing, right? But if you rationally go through it, the more you are explaining it, the worse the idea is, basically, right? If you're looking for more stuff to substantiate, the worse the idea is, right? So the best ideas are like one sentence ideas that you can just not, say a lot about. Just so coherent thoughts, basically. It's a result of a coherent thought.
Some people they've complained in the past about Twitter, right? The character limit and how that is destructive or bad for public discourse. But at the same time, just kind of like what you said, being able or being forced to constrain your idea to 140, 240 characters has been really a big deal. I mean, it's really trained people to communicate or figure out if the idea is good, and can you communicate it in a tweet? Can you communicate it in a meme? Because if you can't, it's probably not that good of an idea. But also, when you come up with a new idea, almost immediately a timer starts, a countdown starts, because either you will forget it, or once you've had that idea, if you're the first person in the world ever in history to have that idea, well, the countdown starts, but you're probably not the first person either.
Yes.
So if you've had that thought, somebody else has had that idea and they might be working on it. And if they aren't working on it, or if they are, you've got to start deciding if this is worth working on, this is worth building, this is worth spending my time, my money, my energy on, or researching to find out if you should just go join somebody else's idea because theirs is much more evolved, or can you even compete with them? You know what I mean? Like, how do you battle that? Because it's almost like this insecurity, like, oh, I just had a great idea. Somebody else is going to have this great idea and they might beat me to market.
Yeah. Well, one, I think you should always share your ideas, but yes,
sure.
What you just said illustrates a big point I have. Like, it's all a individual challenge, right? So if we if us three have the same idea individually, and we would do the exact same things to try and validate it, and we would gather the same information, we would still judge it differently. Because we are all our own individual, and we have certain risk appetite, or maybe certain budget, or certain time, or certain interest, whatever, right? So even if we would do the exact same things, we would still end up at a different place, like our decision about like if we should pursue this idea or not. And I think that challenge, actually the fact that I've been in that, really helped me also get Bitcoin more, right? Because if you start from the point, okay, an idea is random, it probably sucks, I need to challenge myself, so I have to have like an introspective exercise, basically agree to the fact that I know that I don't know everything, and to decide like, okay, with the information that I do have, how do I move forward, basically, and how do I constrain myself? I love that you said that. How do I constrain myself in these little steps so I can also quit on time, right? If I get to the understanding that this idea probably sucks, because the worst thing you can do is to spend time, money, and energy on the wrong idea. Like I talk to so many people who spend tens, hundreds of thousands on ideas, and then after 3 years they realize that if they thought about it like 1 hour longer at the very beginning, they wouldn't have even pursued it, right? And that is, I think, the challenge, that you can kill your darlings, right? That like that's like this technique, right? I don't mean the technique, but like that you do that early, and that also when you have a certain idea that you don't want to pursue, you should still write it down to see if someone else does it. And then if someone else does it, study it, right? Like, okay, what did they do? Is that something I would have done or would have been able to, for example? And I think that's when you can start stacking up like these, whether or not you acted on the decision that something was valuable or not, you can still keep a scorecard for yourself to see if your intuition or your gut feeling also was right. Like if you know, was this a rational thought, yes or no? And that can take some time to figure that out, but I think that's kind of like the training in essence. If you can keep doing that, then you can also trust your mind more in a sense.
Something that we kind of talked about this a little bit before we started recording about the power of smoking weed and having ideas and thinking and having big ideas. And it kind of, you can broaden that to more to psychedelics in general. It's something I've learned as a connoisseur of sorts of the psychedelic substances, is that it's ego, right? Once you kind of get past your personal ego, you kind of, at least personally, I have learned that the importance of me personally having the best ideas is not, that's not the right way to look at it, right? Like everybody is capable of having really good ideas. It really doesn't matter so much that it comes from you, because even though everybody can have great ideas, not everybody can execute on them. Not everybody can recognize them. So as you're coming from this early startup kind of experience in this tech world, this background, it's the importance of recognizing good ideas and then helping either figuring out a way for yourself or helping others to build a framework around executing on those ideas. And I guess I'm wondering, or I guess my thesis is that Bitcoin is one of the best examples of, you have to think less about your personal good ideas and more about how to take the great ideas from this community and work on them together as a network to boost them and to like really help them grow, because that will make all of us more or better off if they succeed.
Yeah. What I think is interesting there is that like usually when you have an idea, the idea is about something that will exist and will be valuable in the future, right? Like the idea is always about the end thing. And that's also why it's really hard that if you would try to do what I just mentioned, right? You basically like chop it up, you make it as small as possible, you time box it and all these things. That already is a really hard thing for people, because they think they are like downgrading their idea. But you cannot do everything at the same time, right? Like if your idea is something that is finished and exists in the future, like what are you going to do tomorrow on Monday? Like tomorrow on Monday, you don't have the thing. And if the idea is like in a certain industry or interest that you are already into for, I don't know, dozens of years, right? Then it's easier to work with like the insecurity or like the unknowns basically around the idea, because you already have a bigger picture idea of this is where that industry could go, for example, right? But lots of people that have startup ideas, right? That, you know, most startup ideas, they are in a, perhaps in a certain trend or stuff with AI right now. But it's still pretty much developing, right? It's still pretty much a wild west. So lots of people that, for example, let's say have ideas to build startups in like the AI space, they jump on this trend, but they don't see like the faraway picture because they have no clue where that's going to end, basically. And then I think it's actually way harder to validate these ideas because the entire foundation, or at least the context in which you're operating in, is super, super shaky. Does that make sense, right? So if you have a belief or an understanding of something in the future, it's easier to move towards that point. But if you're operating in a context that is still very much developing, I always call it like Wild West, right? Like everyone has ideas and everyone is trying stuff. Then, yeah, there's also more information, right, that could distract you, more competitors and all these things. And it is way harder to really think for yourself, basically. And so maybe to jump to Bitcoin in that sense, like with Bitcoin, I think, although the context is shaky of the, you know, when we talk about financial world, when you understand that Bitcoin is just a protocol and it's just doing its thing and it's just a set of rules that's enforced by 15,000 decentralized computers, that is the foundation, right? So anytime you doubt your understanding or you read an opinion of someone where you think like, oh fuck, is this Bitcoin thing like really a thing? You just go back to that basic understanding, right, of Bitcoin is just a protocol. It's just still doing its thing. You can look up the hash rate. Like, is it still working? Yes, it's still working. Okay. You know, and that is like a grounding factor in the uncertainty towards the future, basically. And so that's why I think, you know, when you talk about when you smoke and you think about these big picture ideas, it's easier to go to that place when your ego is out of the way, basically. Because I sometimes also have this when I don't smoke, right, and I think through Bitcoin like rationally, for example, I end up in a place where I think like, wow, could it really be this big? Like, is it really this thing? And then the next second, it's my ego talking. No, it couldn't be this thing. Like, it's just a random thought. Like, something like that, right? Like, not actively, but more like, it's easier to doubt yourself, basically. And that's also why, you know, I think it's cool. Like, you do a podcast, I do a podcast. Like, lots of people do that. But I think it helps when you talk through these ideas with other people that you realize that they also end up in the same place, totally disconnected from you, but they end up in the same rational place. But you only get that when you talk to another person. When you're alone, it's pretty hard actually to battle that ego in a sense. So I think for me, cannabis has really helped me to go to these places and then also like integrate these bigger thoughts where I like ended up.
You mentioned you know, the integration of AI or this explosion of AI. This conversation made me think of a question of like the competition between man and AI and where ideas fit into that frame. It's like, as you mentioned, Dan, you have to have ideas. Like that is like the thing that you have to come to the table with these days, because the thing you're battling is this amalgamation of ideas in a way.
And also, if you have those ideas and you've typed them into your computer, you've searched for them, you wrote a blog post about them, you didn't execute on them. Well, now the way AI works is AI may steal your ideas and share them with other people in more concise form after they've been compressed into these LLMs. So not only now are you competing with, I guess, the AI or the data for just value, they're stealing our ideas, if you want to look at it that way.
They're stealing us. They stole my idea. Yeah, for sure.
That's funny. Like if that idea is able to be like commoditized by the AI, is it a good idea? You know, like
True. One of the things to go back to what you mentioned earlier, which was if you're trying to spend too much time explaining an idea, then it might not be that great of an idea. Maybe you've got to think about it more deeply. But I think about how the where we're at today with Bitcoin adoption and compared to the beginning days. Like today, if you want to get into Bitcoin, you want to learn about Bitcoin, you've got so many podcasts, so many books, countless talks, conferences, just white papers, Bitcoin magazine articles. There's apps to use. There's endless ways to learn about Bitcoin today. But back in 2009, there was a white paper and there was a beta release of the software. That was pretty much all there was. But still, within a few months, people all around the world saw that white paper, they saw that code, and they recognized a good idea. And they started immediately building upon it, sharing it, putting money into it, putting electricity behind it. And it started to grow from there. So there's this, instead of trying to explain your idea, a lot of people need, in my opinion, the best way to do that is to help them, is to create something they can use, to create something that creates value for their lives. So instead of me trying to explain, well, Bitcoin's this network of computers and it talks to other network of computers and they send packets of information back and forth and it's decentralized, that's a lot of jargon, that's a lot of information for people to process. But if you just give them a very intuitive, almost like an interactive meme to use, where they can send that value back and forth, they can see those connections with others, they can make those connections with others. Trying to kind of know your audience on who am I trying to impress with what I've got so far? This is what my idea has evolved to this point. They can help me build to explain it to all the late stage adopters, all the people that will recognize this later once we've built the good foundation. And Bitcoin is like that original foundation that you can just build off of this now. You don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah. Well, and so I think the same mechanism is at play when you think about startups, right? So what I just said to extend on that, when I have an idea and I did some research, let's say I still think it's a good idea, I still have a problem because I need to understand if the people who I think will want this idea actually want this idea, right? And I have to understand where they are coming from right now. Like, do they realize they have a problem? Are they actually looking for a solution? What is their solution, right? Like, a solution is not only a competitor to your idea. It's also, I always say, like, alternative solutions is also doing nothing, right? So you can be aware of a problem and not doing anything. That's also a choice, right? And so as the entrepreneur, it's your job to figure out like where are most people at and can I distill a certain type of segment or group from that I can actually focus on, and I need to learn like how to talk to them, right? Like, how do I talk to them about their problem? How do I talk to them about my solution? And I only have one goal, not for them to use my solution, but for them to understand that I understand them, basically, right? Because only then we can start build a relationship, because if I ship them my first version of my product, probably some stuff still doesn't work and I don't want them to run away, right? So we build the relationship on the understanding of me understanding or them understanding that I understand their problem, basically. And to bridge that to Bitcoin, I think what is interesting with Bitcoin is it's a really big idea, for one, with lots of dimensions. And that is also, I think, why it's so hard to understand, right? Like, or also to explain, basically, because us three ended up in the same place, but through all these different roads, right? Like, I could not backtrack my journey up until now, like specifically, right? Like, what type of content helped me, or what type of thinking, moments of thinking or moments of clarity helped me to eventually get to this. Like I sometimes hear myself say things on my podcast or tweet things out where I think like, wow, 2 years ago, I would have looked at myself like, you're crazy. But now I am at this understanding, right? And if we want more people to understand this thing, it's our job, basically, right? So I don't like it when people say like, oh, it's inevitable, it's going to happen. Like, no, it's not. It's not. You know, most people are not even aware of the problem that they are having, right? So that's one. Yeah. That's one. That's really step one, understanding the problem you have. Yeah.
That, to emphasize what you said, I also cannot go back and retrace my exact journey, but what I can say is that what really connected it and what really set me down the rabbit hole, so to speak, was listening to people who I identified with, who I already thought got me, who understood my way of looking at the world, they understood my concerns. And once those people started speaking to me, you know, whether it was through podcasts or direct conversation about Bitcoin, that's when I really started to listen. Because I don't think that there's anybody in the world at this point today that doesn't understand that the money's broken and that there's the fiat, the central banking system is not working out for them unless they're billionaires. But going to somebody and giving them a 2,000-year summary of what money is, their definition of money is, and why the current money doesn't fit that definition, it's broken. That doesn't solve my problem. Where you got to solve my problem, because Bitcoin, this is going up over time, but I got to be able to buy my groceries tomorrow. Like, well, you got to solve my problem today. And I think that understanding, instead of just telling people like, hey, this is the best thing, explaining how it can fix their individual problems from their perspectives and their context.
Yeah. Well, you're trying to upload an entire 4 years of studying in like a 30-second conversation. It's
right. That's a failure. That's a
fucking impossible to do.
Anyway. But it's also a question again to yourself. Why do you understand this? How do you understand this? How did you integrate this into whatever represents your understanding of this thing? Like, it's so personal. Like that is what really stuck out to me. The understanding of Bitcoin is such a personal journey. We could make a textbook and send that to people, you know, like in high school. That's not going to work. It's just not going to work. It's because this is such an overarching, like multi-dimensional thing. It's just, it basically changes your whole worldview, basically changes how, especially in the West, I think, how you were raised, how you look at economy or not look at economy, basically, and not look at what is money and all these things, you know, all your trust in government and stuff like that. You know, you never had to even question this because your life was so easy in the Western world again. Right. Although everyone has, you know, personal challenges, etc. Like I acknowledge that. But like easy life, super easy life. You never had to question anything. And so that is why this is so hard, because once you do see that, you cannot unsee it. And that's also why it's so hard to explain to other people, like especially people that you love or known for a long time. Right. Where you think like, damn, like, can't you just see this too? But the answer is no. So,
right.
The more, you know, like,
I was just going to say that's another sort of Matrix quote right there. It's, you know, I can't explain what the Matrix is to you. You have to see it for yourself.
Yeah. But this is really the Matrix. Like, I think it is the Matrix, because once you understand that the money is working against you and you're being debased and you're working like 1.5 days a week to pay your government, who doesn't care that you are your individual that you care about. You can still decide to ignore that, and then you live in a matrix. That is, and like, I do see it as the matrix in that sense. So if you willingly ignore it, right? And Dan just mentioned psychedelics, right? Like my psychedelic experience is like, you have to accept it and then you go, right? If you hold it on tight, it will leave. If you chase it, it will also run away, right? So it's about acceptance. And so if you see this, if you see what the matrix is constructed of, and you consciously decide to ignore it, that will not lead to a nice life. The acceptance is the easier step. It's the more scary step, but it is the easier step because it will give you so much clarity that you don't pay attention to all this nonsense bullshit that, you know, people that don't see it pay attention to, right? And so that is just also that for me, like, is one of the things I find really fascinating. And if I look at my own journey, it's really that, like,
yeah,
okay, this is not a nice conclusion, but I cannot change it. It is what it is. Like, once you consciously decide to actually deal with it, yeah, so much stuff clears from your mind, basically.
When you hold on and you refuse to accept it during the psychedelic trip, that's when you have a bad trip. That's when you have
yes.
that piercing anxiety. And what you kind of start to realize is that when you're doing that in your day-to-day life, when you're refusing to accept reality, it's like this less acute, less severe bad trip, but it's your life is just not as enriched and as
yeah.
full as it could be.
Dude, it's ultimate anxiety because
yes,
once you realize
totally.
Once you realize that there's so many other people that don't care that you are you, that have control over things in your life. Once you really realize that and you don't want to do anything about it, that's when you live in like perpetual anxiety because like no one is coming to save you. And that's not a nice conclusion, you know?
I spent most of my 20s with higher anxiety than normal.
Yeah.
And accepting what you just said is how I've come to where I'm at in my mid-30s, where it's my anxiety is very low.
Yeah,
it's still there.
Awesome.
I mean, there's still some anxiety, right? But like it's, you accept reality, you accept that life is it's short and that you've only got so much time and that there's consequences, but you got to keep pushing through.
And also when you decide to accept that you know that you don't know everything, then you also know that other people have no fucking clue what is going on here, right?
No one fucking knows anything. That's
like, like everybody's winging it. Like, seriously, everybody's winging it. So
it's part of slaying your heroes is realizing, oh, I thought this guy was the most brilliant. He had it all figured out. He knew what was going to happen.
Dude.
You're like, oh, he's just a dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's just a dude.
I assure you, if you met Dan and I in real life, we are a couple of fucking retards. That is the truth for sure.
Yeah, right.
My best friend is a special forces police guy, and I've known him for 20 years, and he's a fucking retard, and he walks around with a machine gun. It's like that. It's really like that, you know. Not to say that he's not good at his work. He's really good at his work, but it's all like that. Like, really, you know. And it's so funny because if people listen to this and think like, oh, yeah, well, that makes sense. Take 5 minutes and think about if you actually believe it, if you actually accept it. Because if you don't accept it, you think lesser of yourself with regards to other people. And that is something you have to fix. Because
you want to overcome that, yeah.
Everyone is the same. Like, there's no difference.
So if you have a good enough idea, you can impress Michael Saylor. You can impress, you know, you could have impressed Steve Jobs, whoever. Right? It's...
Yeah.
You kind of got to get over that. That's ego. That's part of the ego. People think of ego as a thing that's like focused on you have too high of an opinion of yourself, but really it's also just you're just too focused on your perspective.
That's what Steve Jobs also says, right? Like, if you look around, everything you see is built or made by people no smarter than you. Like, that's
right.
The,
I was thinking of that exact quote. Yes.
Like, that is true. And everything you see from, you know, I'm looking at books, I'm looking at a Transformer, Lego, that was an idea. And someone manifested that into like the physical world. And that is the only mechanism I think you should understand that anyone can do that, basically.
100%. Bitcoin is one of those things that the more you learn about it, the more you immerse yourself in it, the bigger your ideas about what it can be kind of grow. So I'm curious, since you got into Bitcoin, since you kind of went from, you know, being a Bitcoiner or dabbling in it to this point where you're kind of focused on it, almost, you know, full time, how have your ideas grown? Like, what are some examples of how you've started to rethink or re-see Bitcoin now that you're just so immersed in it?
I think I learned a lot about, back to that part about ideas, right? Like, you have to challenge yourself and figure out if an idea is a good idea before you spend more time on it, right? And time is the most finite asset that we have, and nobody knows how much time they have, right? So it would suck if you would spend your time on something, like too much time on something that is just a bad thing to pursue, basically, right? And it's funny because I understood that before, but I think even like two, three weeks ago or something, I realized that if you decide to spend your time, a finite thing, on something, and you are being paid with something that can infinitely be created, that is just not a rational thing to do.
Right.
So why would you be rewarded for spending that time with, yeah, again, something that can infinitely be created, that you will also be taxed on, and whatever is left, you will also be taxed on when you spend it. Like if you like go down that whole thought, I think you end up in a pretty dark place, actually, when you realize that. For me, that's actually, I'm also thinking through it now that I'm talking about it, but ending up there, like, it was actually pretty profound, where I felt like that just gives away, and this is one of my central topics, I think, in Bitcoin, like, that gives away a certain responsibility over your life to other people that, again, don't care who you individually are, like, not even in a bad way, but you're just so far removed from them that, yeah, like, who are Bram, Mike, and Dan, right? Like, we don't, yeah, they're irrelevant to us. Yeah, like, that's just not okay. So that central theme for me around, like, would you defer responsibilities to other people with knowing that will impact your life? Most people would say no, but everyone is doing it, you know, and yeah, for me, that is a really big topic. Another topic that I love is, I love the soft war thesis by Jason Lowry. I don't know what your guys' opinion on this is, but I love this idea.
I don't get the controversy.
I love this idea.
It.
I don't either.
I don't understand the controversy.
I don't know why they call him a grifter or whatever. Like, I assume that there are smart people who work in the government. They are not all idiots. Right?
They're all just dudes.
And if you read that thesis, it makes so much sense for me that I think it should make sense for some five-star generals to pick up on that. If not, that would be really bad. So that is kind of, like, this is my thinking, right? Like, I can go that place and then I think, like, would the opposite be true? And if the opposite is like, no, that has like a very low probability, then my father's probably right. Does that make sense?
Right.
Like,
right,
as in, you know, a general would pick this up.
Right.
I would choose that over no one is interested in this thing, because that would be, yeah, like, really, really stupid.
If the Pentagon, if the most powerful militaries in the world are not thinking about Bitcoin, at least understanding it at the level that Jason's trying to explain it, or that some of us are thinking about it, we are screwed. Like, that's
exactly
what we consider,
yeah,
so, to be our defense. Yes. Right, what you said, like, we're deferring our defense to these organizations, these institutions. They better at least understand proof of work.
Exactly, yeah. So that thesis, and it's funny because I once tweeted it to Jason, and he liked my tweet, but what I loved was that what I said was, what I love about this thesis is that if you agree that war is in essence perpetual, as in the power projection between people will always be there, right? Because that's also in nature. That's basically what he explains in the book, right? So there will always be fights over territory, over resources, power, ego, whatever. Like, it doesn't actually really matter, but power projection between people, nations, etc., will always be there. That can be something really destructive, as we're seeing in lots of places around the world, right? But if we follow the idea of soft war, right, where countries will compete in computing power, and the incentive, if you want to create more computing power, you have a really big incentive to get cheap or free energy from some place to power that computing power, basically. And so our hunger for war and power projection will lead us to make the earth a greener place. I love that thought. Like, that is just, yeah, I love that. And sorry to add to that, it shows that it's one of those things in Bitcoin where it plays into a certain type of human tendencies, like the greed, for example, like BlackRock getting into Bitcoin. That's greed driven first, right? They want to make fees. They see this as a thing. But you know that they know what this is as well. They figured this out 100%, right? The fact that they are getting into this, like they're pulling in the Trojan horse consciously. I love that. Like I love that they are doing it consciously because they are greedy, but they don't understand that this will be the thing that blows it all up. And so the same for the software thesis, like, oh yeah, I can do this to project my power, etc. But we're fixing the world at the same time that we're waging war that we cannot deny, right? Like I love those things about Bitcoin.
What I like about Bitcoin from that perspective is that I think you're naive if you don't admit that people originally first get in for the number go up. It is that part of that is that greed. Everybody's got a greedy tendency. And so Bitcoin is like this way that it's like a honeypot to get everybody to focus their greedy tendencies, but on a level playing field that's fair for all, that is transparent. Like if you're going to be greedy or if you're going to project power, you're going to do it in a way that everybody else in the network can see, maybe not see you personally are the one doing it, but they can see that it is being projected. They see that that activity is happening and that they can't game the system. So if the world, if BlackRock, if Wall Street, if Russia, if the United States government, if all these entities are putting all of this time, energy, and resources towards Bitcoin, well, at least now we're all putting our energy towards a level playing field, and there's far less people that will be left behind if they choose to participate as well.
Yeah, and they want to use it to, I don't want to say game it, but they want to play it, basically,
yeah,
right? But
right.
The fun thing, I about Bitcoin, I think, is that eventually you will come to realize that Bitcoin has a right to exist because we are also corrupt. We are super corruptible, right? That's the whole point of Bitcoin, is that it helps us to fight that tendency, being corruptible, right? Like anyone who participates in a system that would be, open to be corrupted, they will take advantage of it, whether they, would want to say like, oh no, I would never do that. Like, yes, you would. Like
yes.
Everyone would, right? And that's the point. And again, something of acceptance, right? Like once you accept that, you will also understand that we need a way to exchange value that is incorruptible, so that when we all participate in this incorruptible thing, it's a fair game.
Yes,
and currently,
100%.
It is not a fair game. Right?
And yeah, and everybody's first cycle. I mean, not even everybody. Some people don't learn very quickly. Everybody's first cycle, they're like, I'm smarter than this. I can trade trade the shit coins.
Yeah.
I can do this stuff.
For sure.
And they eventually learn. They eventually learn. And the hodlers, the people with the most experience, they sit back and they say, oh, here comes BlackRock. Wall Street's going to play their games. And they are going to strike out and they're going to lose money if they don't just follow the right incentives and the right way of using this. And it's every 4 years you get to watch it. You get to watch new people come in with their clever ideas, and you say, all right, what's the quote from the Fight Club? He's like, how's that working out for you, being clever?
Dude, I mean, we are at six. I was just looking at it. It's unfortunate.
We're at all time high.
It's 69,442, just shy of 420. Do you feel anything? I don't feel anything.
No one feels anything. Yeah, that's
how
true.
Chill are
Euphoria
we?
Is definitely
what
not
the
good.
Hell? Like we are crabbing for a week above all-time high, and it's nothing, like nothing. I'm getting these texts like, oh, you must be so happy. Oh, but I was like, I don't
I'm feel bored.
Like, yeah, there's
yeah,
nothing
bored,
going
like...
on. Yeah, 100K or bust, like that's the thing. And also maybe fun to tie back to, validating ideas and stuff. For me, $100,000 is my mental barrier that's my last thing I need to believe. is once we hit 100K, it's going to be a million and 10 million. Like, that is my last kind of like understanding slash conviction thing. Like, the 100K seemed so far away, seemed such a ridiculous thought, right? And I don't know. I don't know where I put that as like the last thing to that I need to see before I like really accept this thing. But yeah, that's it for me.
I agree with you. I think once we get to 100K, the ride to a million could be very, very short. And I don't think it happened in that day, but you know what I mean? Like within a year, within a cycle or two, it's going to be a million. Because I was thinking just about it back in January, we were having conversations. I was having conversations with my dad. I was having conversations with Bitcoiners. We see it on Bitcoin Twitter. It was like, are we going to even be anywhere near the all-time high or on the halving? Or when do we get back to 69? And then something happened. And this was in February when we hit 50K. And for me, there was some mental barrier there about it going back above 50K. And once it did that, I mean, boom, the ride to 70 has been a couple of weeks. So who knows what could happen? I think 75 will get us to 100 quick too.
So fun, eh? So fun. It's so entertaining for me right now. Like,
it is just a good time.
It's pure entertainment. Like, I'm super interested, obviously. Like, I'm into this every day. But it's so entertaining. It's so wild to realize that we actually front ran the people that have to figure this out. Like, their job is to figure this out day in, day out. And we already knew this like 5 years ago. You know, like,
I know.
That's so funny to see. It's also, again, like for that, you know, challenging your personal beliefs and stuff, like, that is the signal. The signal is that if you ended up here, you did the work. You can trust yourself. You can trust your thinking.
100%.
You can really do that. You can really, really do that.
It gives you a lot of self-confidence.
That's why it's so entertaining.
Yeah.
Sorry?
It gives you a lot of self-confidence when you ride it out and you were proven correct. You know, some people like to just throw it in others' face and they like to celebrate, me included. But it also just is like that personal self-confidence of like, I picked the right thing, or I was right about this. I put all this time and energy, mental energy, and it's paying off.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's just really cool. Yeah.
Bram, I have a question. I do have a question. Where are you spending most of your time these days? And what is the sort of monetary fiat temperature over there?
You mean country-wise?
Yeah.
I'm in the Netherlands.
Okay.
So we once ruled the world.
All I see from the Netherlands are all these like protests,
farm protests
of the farmers. Yeah.
And
I'm curious about all this kind of,
Oh yeah, no. I think that's what you see on the farmer protests. I don't see them a lot actually. It's maybe like 6 months ago, but yeah, that's a really big topic. So actually, this was last year was an election year. They're still forming the cabinet, so that's taking some time. But you know, once you basically see the matrix, you also see all the bullshit that people talk about, which is now, super fascinating. Actually, I got added. I was on a Dutch radio, like a finance station, and we talked about Bitcoin. And then after that, I got added to this Telegram group, like 250 people in it, like politicians, people from banks, journalists, Bitcoiners, and it's all about Bitcoin. And there's two guys from the financial newspaper, and I just realized at one point they don't have a clue. They are just writing nonsense, like pure nonsense. And I asked, like, why do you write this down? And then they said, like, to fill this newspaper and to make people aware of the dangers of Bitcoin. And then I said, but, like, did you actually study this? And then he said, well, it's my job. And then I said, well, that doesn't mean you actually understand it.
That didn't answer my question.
Yeah, but, and so at that point, I realized, okay, like, I consider myself an expert in this after 10 years, and I know that what you're writing down is nonsense. So what else is nonsense? You know, what else that I write is nonsense? Like, well, like, if you still think, like, everyone is just a random other person.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and people are corruptible.
There's
you know,
there's
like I, yeah.
There's that, something that, called, you know, there's something called Gelman amnesia effect that you just described, right? Where so if you know something very well, like Bitcoin's a great example, and you read the newspaper and you just see how full of just counterfactuals or just pure nonsense that an article, and then you go out and you read the rest of the newspaper and you read it as if the rest of the newspaper isn't filled with just as much bullshit as what you just read.
Yes.
And that's called Gelman amnesia effect. Yeah. And there's, I think people are kind of waking up to this, is the more they
the
know
same
about
thing.
It's the same thing. Like, do you want to accept that that is the case or not? Right.
Right.
And
it's
at
scary
that point,
to accept.
When you read to the rest of the newspaper, you're not really ready to, like, you know, give yourself that shock, basically. But yeah, I do think that's what's happening. And maybe it's also because I feel that more, that I see that other people are feeling that more, in a sense, right? But I don't know, you can only lie that much to people or tell them nonsense until they start figuring it out, right? Like, although I'm in Western Europe, I do look a lot at like American politics and stuff. And when I sometimes see like clips from, I don't know what her name is, but like the
Elizabeth Warren,
who's always at the White House press conference, the African American woman.
I don't remember her name, but she's the press. Yeah,
oh,
the press
my
secretary.
God! Like, sometimes I hear her say things, and I think like, wow, you. I genuinely think like, wow, you hate other people. You think they are retarded? Like, really? Like, I don't mean that in like a bad way towards her, or, you know, whatever she has that position. But the fact that
Jean-Pierre, that's her name.
Yeah. Like that those are like the talking lines, like the communication lines. I'm like, wow, that is, again, or most people are retarded or they hate the people of the country, right?
Right. There's a little bit of both.
Well, I go to the latter, but, you know, it's wild. It's crazy. It, when you see stuff like that and you think like that, and then I think about, okay, you know, if you go to your spam folder in Gmail, you see all these messages, right? And you think like, well, how the hell does this work? The fact that you're still getting them shows you it still works. There's still people thinking there's a Nigerian prince or someone from Iraq that will give them $50 million after they sent them $50,000.
Yeah, right.
Like, people still believe it. And that is also why we still see these communication lies. Like, in some way, enough people still swallow this, they still accept this, or they don't care, one of the two. But not enough people are like, I'm done, I what the fuck are you talking about? Like, I walk out so outside of my house in a big American city and I trip over fentanyl needles and tents. And you're saying that everything is resilient and sound and all the, like, what are you talking about? You know, and I think in Europe, it's we are always a bit further behind, I think, behind America. I always think like 1-2 years in certain ways. That was always the case back in the day with like music and stuff like that. But I also think like politically wise, you know, this year is an election year in, I think, over half of the countries in the European Union. So we will see big shifts there. But yeah, the tension is definitely here also.
A Malay moment happening in Eastern Europe or in Europe at all? Like a conservative coming in? And
well, I don't know. Like, maybe this year. But also like conservative, you know, like when I was younger, I would never have labeled myself a conservative. Now, I also don't know really, but if people say like, oh, Milei is a conservative, like I try to look at people without any prejudice or like certain glasses on. I just listen to him and I think like, okay, this is a rational guy.
Yeah, rational.
And then at one point, there was an interview of Milei in a TV show and they asked him about death. Like, are you afraid of death? His answer was like one of the best answers I've ever heard about death and life and what life is worth. And he talked about love and his family and that, you know, it's not about power but about sharing love, etc. But just the entire answer, I was like, okay, this is a good guy. Like, you cannot fake, maybe I'm naive, but you cannot fake that, right? People who would want to fake that would not give that answer, right? And
sure.
So I think that is what a lot of people do yearn for. Like just seeing that this is another person. It doesn't have to be like good news all the time. It's not like, oh, like that. That is what you hear. Like people just want,
right. Like we just had the president.
Real talk. You know,
we just had the president give the State of the Union, and I don't think that there's any rational person who looks at the current state of the United States and thinks, oh, this is great, this is positive. And he comes out and he tries to give like this fake, like there was a lot of anger in there, but he was also trying to say a lot of things were going well. And it's like, you don't always have to lie. You don't have to, you know, you shouldn't lie at all, but like you can be honest. You can kind of say, hey, things are not going great. We have to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and figure out how to solve this thing. We don't have to always project this facade of everything is going well, everything's growing. We have endless growth, endless strength. It's sometimes the honesty and the vulnerability actually is more beneficial to kind of give that.
But enough people are still accepting it, so it's still
sure, exactly. So
it's still what it is. Yeah.
You know, we mentioned the price. So we're hitting this bull market, but you know, as we kind of wind this episode down a little bit, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about Bitcoin for Millennials, your podcast, and kind of what you're working on going forward here, and like what people can do to like collaborate with you or to maybe get some of your consulting or some of your expertise on they're looking to start their own Bitcoin, you know, startup or tech startup in general.
Yeah, thanks. So 6 months ago, I started this podcast, Bitcoin for Millennials. I had like, I think 4 or 5 conversations with friends or just like other millennials that week, where I was just like, they all have money, they don't have Bitcoin, and I'm just trying to orange pill them. One now has 1 Bitcoin, so I'm happy with that, just because I kept yapping at him. But then I just realized, like, even though you might profit in a fiat system, you can still not understand it, right? And that is actually when it gets harder to realize and then accept that you got lucky in a sense, right? It's not that you did not do work, but the entirety of the system is designed to work against you, and you in some way got lucky, right? So when I had those conversations, I was like, okay, how can I talk to these people that, yeah, again, growing up in a Western country, never getting taught about money or economics, money was never a problem, right? I mean, like, if you're poor in this country, you're still richer than the average, I don't know, you know, name any Eastern or African country. You just don't have you never had a problem, so you don't have an incentive to think about this and to basically challenge this. So that was like one. And I think in the week before or after, like, so it was just in the space of 2 weeks, I talked to like 4 Bitcoiners, and just a call like this. And we, at the end, we were like, oh, this was a nice discussion. We should have recorded this and then just shared it with others, right? And then I thought, well, why am I not going to do this? Because I already decided, like, I want to contribute to Bitcoin in a certain way. And then I thought, okay, well, why not another podcast? But by niching it down to like 4 millennials, I think, you know, we are going to inherit the money of the world. People are starting families. They have had certain career up until certain point. So they should have some money, some savings, you know, wishes, thoughts for the rest of their life, like how they want to build their life, basically. But they have no clue about how the system works that they are participating in. And I was exactly the same. I was 30. I had a mortgage. I was working at a bank until a colleague explained to me, did you know that the money in the bank is not yours? And I was like, I'm an idiot. Like, I'm participating in this and I have no clue. And I'm working at a bank. Hello. You know, so that is like my main driver there is, and of course, like, I have people who are Gen Z or boomers or Gen Xers who listen to it, you know, everyone can listen to it, of course, but just by adding that to the title, it's like, okay, I want to talk to my own generation, which is still a big enough niche, right? So that's basically the story behind it. I just started it. I have one goal, which is 100 episodes, like the Mr. Beast strategy. You make 100 episodes, you figure out if it's valuable, if people want to listen to it and follow you. And yeah, it's going great actually up until now. So I think I have like 6,000 plays on Spotify every month. Last month I had like 50,000 views on YouTube and 3,000 subs now. So in some way,
yeah,
I don't
talk
know,
to you.
I think of myself as another random dude, but in some way I'm doing something right. And I'm happy that people are enjoying it and I'm connecting with people all over the world. So it's super rewarding for one. And so, yeah, if anybody wants to check that out, it's a Bitcoin for Millennials on YouTube, Spotify, etc.
For our listeners, I recommend start with Eric Kaysen, Jeff Booth episodes, or even our favorite, one of our favorite guests, Eric V. Stacks, is on there. So I think you'll get into that. And all the rest of the roster of guests is really excellent, but it's great. It's a great podcast.
Yeah, and maybe to add to that, like, when you see those guests, I never thought I would talk to all these
right.
people that everyone knows, basically. But I think that is the beauty of Bitcoin is that, you know, it does. Everyone is literally a random other person, and it doesn't matter where they come from. They all did the same work. They all had a personal journey in challenging their, you know, worldviews, beliefs, all these things. And if you look at Jeff Booth's last talk at Bitcoin Atlantis, like, this is exactly what he talks about, right? The fact that it's so personal, and therefore that is what you connect on when you meet like other Bitcoiners. And that's also why in some way I've been able to have these people on, because we are just connected in some way and they love to talk about their own journey. You know, I mean, that's also why I'm sitting here. Like, I think just sharing about the work that you did is already the inspiration, hopefully, for someone else to do that too. Right. And so, yeah, I think that's my most important message. Yeah.
Awesome. Other than the podcast, where would you like to send the listeners to learn more about you or connect with you?
Yeah, I think mainly to my X account, which is Bramk, B-R-A-M-K. And they can check out my website and like my services at kenstein.co.
Yeah, that'll all be in the show notes. Brandon, this is a great conversation. We should definitely do it again. We'll try to do it on like a Friday night or something so you can smoke with us.
Yeah.
We can maybe get into a little bit more of the high level ideas, quote unquote. So, but yeah, this was awesome. It was great talking to you. Thanks for coming on on the show.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Awesome. All credit. Thank you again for listening to the High Hash Rate Podcast with Dan and Mike. If you want to learn more about the podcast and see what we're up to, you can find us at highhashrate.com. Or if you just want to speak to a couple of baked ADIQ plebs, reach out to us at hello@highhashrate.com. Or you can reach out to us at the High Hash Rate handle on X. Later, everybody.
Holy Toledo!